The Guardian.
In the first part of our serialisation of Jonathan Powell's book, we concentrate on how the government, Tony Blair and Jonathan Powell, brought Sinn Féin and the Republican movement in from the cold. You have some pretty colourful, extraordinary descriptions of these historic first meetings with Sinn Féin. The actual first one was in Stormont in October 97, but the big one was Downing Street, December 97. Can you tell us about those?
Yes, they were remarkable meetings. For us, Adams and McGuinness were bogeymen for a long period. One hadn't been able to hear even their voices on television. They'd been part of a movement that had run a very effective terrorist campaign. And it was a very strange moment to meet them in Stormont. The meeting had been arranged in a very small room with no windows. And Gerry Adams was just saying to me last week when I was interviewing him, he said he went in and there was a Venetian blind on one side of the room. So he went up to it and opened it. And right behind the Venetian blind was a wall of concrete. So someone had made absolutely sure that no one was going to be looking in at this meeting. It was quite a nervous meeting. Tony Blair, to his credit, shook their hands and said that he'd done so afterwards in the press conference and treated them like any other human beings. I have to say, to the not particularly great credit of me and Alastair Campbell and John Holmes and the others there, we decided not to shake their hands. It was a nervous meeting and a short one, and we didn't get a real impression of them. But the Downing Street meeting was really, it felt like a historic occasion at the time. There was a lot of anticipation in No. 10 Downing Street itself, with people discussing whether they were going to say hello or whether they weren't going to say hello. And I remember outside there were more TV cameras even than when we'd arrived in May 97. Again, Adams and McGuinness were relatively nervous. Adams started off with a little speech about the portraits of previous prime ministers down the corridor of No. 10 Downing Street, indicating that none of them had succeeded in getting peace in Northern Ireland, even Gladstone. And Martin McGuinness, however, rather upset us to start with, because before sitting down in the cabinet room, he looked around him and held the back of his seat and he said, so this is where all the trouble happened then. And we all, on our side of the table, assumed he was talking about the mortar attack on No. 10 when John Major had been Prime Minister. And I chirped in saying, yes, the mortars came in just behind you and landed in the garden. And my brother, who was John Major's private secretary for foreign affairs at the time, dragged John Major under the table. And then they, after some policemen came running in waving guns, they then scarpered quick. And Martin just looked rather horrified, said, no, I don't mean that. I meant this is where the treaty was signed. By Lloyd George and Michael Collins. So they had a rather longer historical perspective than us of this whole dispute.
And can I just ask you, you obviously paid at that time a great deal of attention to what was then the second or third largest party in Northern Ireland. We, the media, paid an enormous amount of attention to them. Now, that was not because they were the second or third largest party in Northern Ireland. It was because they had an influence over the IRA. When you met Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness in that period, did you think you were just meeting the president of Sinn Féin and Sinn Féin's chief negotiator, or were you meeting people who either had influence over the IRA or were actually part of the IRA leadership?
Seamus Mallon's complaint is always that we disable the SDLP by talking to Sinn Féin and that we talked to Sinn Féin because they had the guns. And my answer to that is yes, and your point is exactly. We were trying to talk to the people with guns because we were trying to bring a peaceful resolution to a conflict that had gone on for 30-odd years, or even 40 years by that stage. So we were talking to the people who had influence on the people with guns. Whether or not they were members of the Army Council, I'm not in a position to prove one way or the other, but it was pretty clear they were the leaders of the Republican movement, and that included physical force Republicans.
And it is interesting that in the book, you actually say that at one point, Tony Blair actually says to Sinn Féin, look, why don't I meet the leadership of the IRA? Didn't happen, but that's quite a big thing for a Prime Minister to do, isn't it?
Yes, he was always convinced of the powers of persuasion that he had to win people over. It wasn't just once, about three or four times he suggested that to Gerry Adams that he should meet the IRA Army Council. And each time Adams said, well, not really sure about that. One time he said, yes, maybe, but then it came to nothing. And I talked to him afterwards about it, and he said that actually it wouldn't have served any very useful purpose to have Tony sit down. It would have been an interesting encounter, but it wouldn't really have persuaded the IRA to do anything. In the end, it had to be, he says, he, Adams, plus McGuinness, to persuade the Army Council and the IRA leadership to do things. And I think he's probably right when I come to think about it.
And presumably some of the faces round the table, if it had been the Army Council, might possibly have been quite familiar faces.
I suppose they could have worn masks. But the thing about the IRA and Sinn Féin, that when I first started doing the job, I rather believed the traditional British and unionist line that IRA, Sinn Féin were one organisation, and indeed the Republican movement is one organisation. But it brought home to me over time that actually there are gradations within the movement, and trying to persuade people to come over can't just be done by one person. Adams and McGuinness were not in a position to just say, this is what will happen. They had to win people over. Tony used to compare the Army Council to the old Labour NEC, which I thought was a rather good comparison.
But it is interesting, there is one person who you do sort of single out as being the absolutely key person who needed to be convinced on the Army Council, was convinced, and that's Brian Keenan.
Well, I didn't say Brian Keenan was on the Army Council. Indeed, I don't think he was on the Army Council. But he was a very, very important man. He would have been the man behind the mainland campaign in Britain in the 80s, and a very significant leader who had huge kudos within the movement, became very sick. But it seemed to me that he was very important in carrying the armed force movement forward. I don't think Adams and McGuinness would have been able to win them over without his blessing. And it was very lucky for us, I guess, that he didn't die either from his illnesses during this period.
And it's an interesting sign of how far that movement moved on, because I think it was in the early 90s, he said that the only thing that will be decommissioned in Ireland will be the British state.
Mm. Yes. Yeah. No, I mean, it was, if you think about it, it's amazing how far Republicans moved, given their original position and where they actually ended up, what they achieved. They accepted consent. They accepted that the future of Northern Ireland was to be decided by the people of Northern Ireland. What I guess they gained was the end of the unionist veto. They gained the ability to bring about change in Northern Ireland. And that's what they really wanted and what their supporters and people really wanted.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because you obviously got to know the Republican movement and the leadership very well, because you actually had quite a few secret one-on-one meetings, sometimes in the Clonard Monastery in West Belfast, sometimes in Derry. There's one example, I think, in 1998, where you travelled incognito to Derry to meet Martin McGuinness.
Yes, I retraced my steps for the TV programme for that. It was fascinating. We went back there, and I hung around outside the hotel and waited till two rather rough-looking guys came up to me and said, Martin sent us, put me in the back of a car, and drove me round and round in ever-decreasing circles till we ended up at a house in a suburb of... well, actually, it was just outside the Bogside in Belfast, in Derry. And I knocked on the door, and there was Martin McGuinness inside, and we had our... a little meeting there.
Do you think you got the balance right? I know that there is this theory that the way to treat the Northern Ireland peace process was like a bicycle, and the bicycle must keep moving, and if it doesn't move, it will fall over. And that obviously it's a balancing act, because you had to keep all sides on board. What the critics would say, and certainly you got a lot of flack from the Conservatives, certainly in the early stages, was that there were too many concessions to Sinn Féin and the Republican movement. In hindsight, is there a point to that?
Yes, I tried to write the book without the benefit of hindsight, and that was the advantage of being able to write it from my diaries and from the government papers of the time, because we made a lot of mistakes along the way, and it was quite interesting going back over the papers and retracing the steps and thinking how I'd have done things differently if I'd only realised what people were really saying to me and seized on the points that, in retrospect, appeared to be important. So I'm not claiming at all that we did it the right way. I think we went down a number of cul-de-sacs in the process. I'm a bit sceptical about this argument that we, if only we'd not made concessions. Again, talking to David Trimble, he says, well, the IRA were never going to go back to violence after OMO. You should have kept the big stick and threatened them by prisoner release. But I don't really believe either parts of that thesis are right. We certainly believed at the time there was every chance that the IRA might go back to violence, just as they had with the Canary Wharf bomb. And we didn't know quite how to judge what their bottom line was. So instead of aiming for the lowest possible price of the agreement, we had to weigh up the significance of getting an agreement and making it last. Where I think we did make a mistake, probably in retrospect, was, as I described it in the book, running up and down the seesaw, offering concessions to one side and offering concessions to the other to try and keep the thing balanced. And in the end, that led to really a loss of credibility in the agreement and indeed in us, particularly amongst the unionist population. And we probably should not have done that. But at the time, that balancing seemed to be necessary to keep that bicycle upright.
But some of the concessions were pretty strong. I mean, in the Good Friday Agreement negotiations, you write about how publicly there was an agreement that prisoners would be let out within 2 years. But privately, Tony Blair said to Gerry Adams, we'll do it after a year.
Yes, no one's ever referred to that before. And it's interesting that Adams in particular has never referred to it. What happened was that Moe appears to have suggested to Adams and McGuinness that we could somehow let prisoners out after 1 year, and she came to tell us about it. And we had with us John Steele, who was the senior Northern Ireland Office official dealing with it, who himself was a unionist, sort of middle ground unionist, exactly the sort of person we wanted to win over. And he said, no way, you could sell that. So we then tried to take the concession back off Gerry Adams at that stage, who reacted not terribly well. And we were afraid we'd lose the whole process at that stage. So Tony did then say that if circumstances were right, he would try and do it in 1 year rather than 2 years. And Adams reminded us of that promise a couple of times over the years, although he never called it in. And in the end, the prisoners were only released after 2 years.
And that Tony Blair, in a separate part of the negotiations, was prepared to have an argument, a row even, with the army over the dismantling of those watchtowers down in South Armagh. That was quite something for a Prime Minister to be prepared to have a row with the army or not. They should do what the politicians tell them to.
They should certainly do what the politicians tell them to do on these sort of matters. Tony never had a row with them. He actually handled it very cleverly. What happened was that in the negotiations it became increasingly clear that we wouldn't win over not only Sinn Féin, but we wouldn't win over the Irish government or the nationalists on this issue unless we could make some steps towards demilitarisation. The military argued that you had to be careful about how you did it because we still had the dissident threat. And they wanted to make any demilitarisation conditional on that threat being completely and utterly destroyed. The argument that Adams and McGuinness made to us was you couldn't be sure that that would happen. And in fact, by leaving a large military presence in places like South Armagh, you were probably making the dissident threat worse. What you really needed was local Republicans stopping that dissident threat happening, and that would only occur if you could reduce the military presence. So we never had a row with the military, but the military did sometimes, or individuals, it seemed to me to come quite close to telling politicians what to do on a political issue. But in the end, actually, they came around to it, and the police, the Northern Ireland police, were particularly forward in their thinking on this and helped win over the army on the subject.
For more discussion and analysis, download Guardian Daily. That's The Guardian's news podcast, available first thing in the morning, Monday to Friday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.